We're going to go ahead and call the meeting in the Arizona State Board of Podiatry for February 12th, 2020 at 8:31 a.m. Physician members are present, Drs. Foreman, Ilano, and Campbell. Mr. John Rhodes, our public member, is present, as well as our Attorney General, Assistant Attorney Generals, Seamus Monahan and Mark Harris, and our Executive Director, Heather Brodus. Does anyone have any declarations of conflicts of interest at this meeting? And then we have a remark and announcement from Mr. Rhodes. Board member appreciation.
On behalf of the state of Arizona and the Arizona Board of Podiatry, I'd like to thank Dr. Barbara Campbell for her service to the board. She's been a board member since 2010 and is currently serving her second term as board president. And with that, I'd like to present this to...
Oh, well, what a sweet surprise. Thank you. That was a real surprise. Thank you. Nice way to start the meeting. Thank you so much. All righty. So we'll go on here with our review and discussion of our minutes in the previous meetings. We have our January 22nd general session board minutes. Does anyone have any concerns with those minutes or changes?
I make a motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. And then we have our executive session minutes from January 22nd of 2020. Any conditions or problems with those?
I make a motion to approve the minutes for the executive session board meetings for January 22nd, 2020.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Do we have any discussion on this? Vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right. Our next item here is our investigation files. And since we have one of our cases here with the doctor and his counsel plus the complainant, we'll take the other matters first and then we will do that file last. So we're going to begin with file 19-21-C, which is Dr. Keith Goss, and investigator is Dr. Polakoff. We don't have the doctor present or any complaints. So, morning, Dr. Polakoff.
Good morning, board. This is Dr. Deidre Polakoff. Case 19-21-C, Keith Goss, DPM. The patient, JB, initiated a board complaint against Keith Goss for a failed surgery. Dr. Goss performed the surgery 7/11/2017 to stabilize a broken ankle. He used pins and rods. JB is alleging that the metal contaminated the bone, eventually leading to amputation of his right foot. JB followed up with Dr. Bland after Goss left the hospital up in Tuba City. He underwent numerous operations to correct the contamination, which eventually failed, resulting in the amputation of his right foot on 12/18/2018, approximately a year and a half after the surgery. Corrective but failed operations took place numerous dates, and the patient was hospitalized for almost 9 months. The allegation of failed surgery and complication leading to amputations, unsubstantiated. The patient, unfortunately, was an uncontrolled diabetic who had documented multiple visits to the ER, triage clinic, and the podiatry clinics. He initially saw Dr. Goss and the other doctors who were treating patients up in Tuba City in 2015. There was a note from the triage clinic on 6/7/2017 that the right foot was numb. He's a diabetic but not taking his medications. He reported that a piece of heavy metal fell onto his foot at work. and from that time he felt severe pain, even though his feet were numb. The documentation had to be submitted several times from Tuba City to get the correct documentation and for them to comply with the subpoenas. There was a note in the documentation from the triage clinic that the right foot and leg were numb. They started hurting in March of 2017, and this note was from June of 2017 from the triage clinic. The foot is not much better due to dropping piece of metal at work. Toes are numb, not taking diabetic medication. X-ray report shows pain, right foot indications for x-rays, fractures noted to proximal second, third, and fourth metatarsals. Intermediate cuneiform is not visible, which suggests complete destruction. Dislocation of the third through fifth metatarsal junction, severe Charcot dislocation disease, refer immediately to podiatry clinic. The patient was seen in the podiatry clinic by Dr. Goss and by a nurse practitioner. The report was signed by a nurse practitioner on 6/14/2017. Patient dropped metal on foot, diabetic, refused to take insulin, right foot, no protective sensation, bilateral feet, positive edema, positive erythema, positive skin intact, positive pulses but weak. X-ray is comminuted fracture, prolapse of Taylor dome. Discuss surgical option versus non-surgical. Again, this was signed by PD, a nurse practitioner. On 7/11/2017, a radiology report reads, the right Charcot reconstruction with intermedullary nail and external fixation. Post-op changes of hind foot fusion of the tibial Taylor and subtalar joints. Internal fixation hardware appears intact. There are osteotomy changes of the distal tibia and Taylor dome. There is resection of the distal diaphyseal portion of the fibula. This surgery performed by Dr. Goss was performed on 7/11/2017, the same day as the radiology report that I just read to you. Unfortunately, Dr. Goss left the hospital immediately after that surgery, and was not able to go back to the hospital due to his termination from the hospital. An operative report was never placed on file, and we could never obtain an operative report. It was confirmed by the custodian of records from Tuba City that we did not have an operative report from that date. The next morning, on 7/12/2017, the patient was seen at bedside, with edema, a fever, continued non-weight bearing until foot plate is in place. Continue IV antibiotics, possible DC in 2 weeks, signed by unknown. The next day, patient refused to speak with the social worker concerning his potential discharge and diabetic medications, and it went on from there that the patient continued to have trouble with his diabetes. He was non-weight bearing. The chart was signed 2 days after surgery by Dr. Devin Bland, DPM. It appears that Dr. Goss left the hospital immediately after surgery. He was terminated. And according to the records of the radiology report, everything appeared to be intact for hardware. The surgery that was performed is a TTC fusion. And it appears that Dr. Bland has expertise and knowledge of the surgery. He is a guest lecturer on lectures for this surgery called Compress Your Way to Success, Clinical Perspectives on Nitinol TTC Fusion Technology, presented by Kenneth Goss, DPM, in Tuba City, Arizona. At this time, due to the trauma that the patient had from dropping a piece of metal on his foot in March of 2017, seeing the triage unit in June of 2017, reading the radiology report pre-op and the radiology report post-op, I do not have the operative report. All appears to be indicating that the operation was appropriate for this compression, dislocation, Charcot foot patient, I found that the report was unsubstantiated.
Did you have a chance to talk to Dr. Goss about the operative report?
I did not. He did not have any records. I did speak to Tuba City many times, and we had the old AG representative assist, but it was very hard to get records. Then they finally put in writing that they did not have an operative report.
Okay.
According to Dr. Goss's letter, he left immediately after, was not allowed back into the hospital.
He was an uncontrolled diabetic at the time.
And had, going back to 2015 of his noncompliance.
And he had previous amputations.
He had previous amputation of a digit and a finger.
And as I understand it, he was he fell a few times during the surgical course.
He fell many times, and he went from the hospital is very good about giving medical supplies. He was given a lot of medical supplies to take care of his post-op surgical wound, and then he would go back to triage clinic, and he had no supplies to take care of his wound. He was living in his truck for a while, which is very hard on the amputee, and he was able to go back to the hospital, and they would admit him for 3 months at a time to take care of his wound. And all the surgeries that were performed subsequently by Dr. Bland, which were numerous, appeared to have the latest techniques in salvage, and it appears that they really tried to help the patient.
And I believe, Dr. Polakoff, that in Dr. Goss's response, he indicated he didn't feel like continuity of care was carried on for this patient?
Right. There was some contention between Dr. Goss and Dr. Bland, and Dr. Bland, who took care of the patient afterwards. And this could be read into all the procedures done by Dr. Bland, because he would also add a note. The surgery was performed by Dr. Goss, and he would make note that it's definitely not his surgery that he was taking care of or cleaning up from. But everything that the triage nurses, the radiology reports, indicated that there were no overt signs of misalignment of the hardware, misalignment of the bone. It appeared that his first post-op x-ray was in good order, and that was done immediately the day of surgery from the radiology report.
And just as an aside, I think, you know, most of the time op reports are usually dictated by the resident. Now, the resident saw the patient at bedside on the 12th, and usually then that's co-signed by the attending, but since Dr. Goss was no longer there, and, you know, just kind of out here in the cloud about where this where the operative report is, if it was even actually done, but we have no way of dealing with that part of this complaint. So it's an unfortunate situation, again, you know, with a person with that many comorbidities, and how that process can pan out with disease process and noncompliance, et cetera, and then what he did eventually end up with an amputation. We had seen this individual before in the complaint against Dr. Bland, so everybody was pretty well familiar with it. So I agree with Dr. Polakoff's investigation report and believe that there were no violations of state statutes. Mr. Bowes, did you have any questions?
No, I don't.
No, I'm with you there.
So I would move to dismiss case 19-21-C, seeing that there were no violations of state statutes.
A second.
Second.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you, Dr. Polakoff.
Thank you.
And we will go ahead and then move to, is it Dr. Jean Crone is how that name is pronounced, Heather? And the case number is 19-43-C. The doctor is not present, nor is the complainant, but we have Dr. Polakoff who did the investigation of the case.
Morning, Board. I'm Dr. Polakoff on 1943C, Crohn DPM. I did receive a complaint from patient JM against Dr. Gene Crohn for concerns of charging unreasonable fees to Medicare and charging her for items that should have been covered by Medicare. The patient went to see Dr. Crohn for a fourth toe and complaints of a bunion pain. During the course of surgery, the doctor advised the patient that she needs a post-op surgical boot so that she may allow to take a shower but not get her wound wet. The patient was charged $25 for the water boot, and the patient said that she could not use that, so she returned it. And she was upset because when she returned the boot, the doctor told her that she has to sign for the boot because she paid cash and she had to document that cash was returned. The patient stated that she had to sign and was intimidated to sign by both the patient's assistant and the patient's mother, who both witnessed her signature. She was also advised that the $25 that she would be returned would be applied to her surgical shoe and not be refunded to her. The patient stated that this was against Medicare because Medicare should have paid for the surgical shoe, but she was later advised that the surgical shoe was not covered by Medicare. And this is confirmed that surgical shoes are not covered. And the patient was eventually returned the $25. She is concerned about Medicare being overcharged, and she was feeling that she was being overcharged by Dr. Crohn. When she was allowed to get back into regular shoes, the only shoes that she has are Keds. And Dr. Crohn advised her that the Keds are too tight and ill-fitting for her and will hurt her post-op foot. The patient stated that they are not too tight, and even though she could not get the shoe back on, sitting in the chair, she stood up from the post-op treatment chair in the office and forced her foot in the Keds and told Dr. Crohn, see, the Ked fits fine. When she came for another post-op, it was noted that the fifth toe was now curling under and pushing against the surgical fourth toe. Dr. Crohn advised her that the fourth toe will be affected negatively if the fifth toe still pushes against it, and she recommended other shoes such as New Balance or any wider, longer shoe, but the patient stated that her Keds are her shoe of choice, and she has two pairs of them, so she would like to wear them. Upon review, I found no violation of state statutes in how the patient was treated, the documentation, the surgical course. All appeared to be minimal, conservative, and within order of standard of practice. I found no violation of state statutes in this care.
No, I don't.
I agree. I agree.
Mr. Rhodes? No, I find no violations of state statute, and I'd move to dismiss 19-43-C.
I do have, in discussion, though, I do have one comment. I think that the doctor should be made aware that she should have had an ABN form signed in the records for the surgical shoe, so there wouldn't have been any question from the patient that it was a non-covered item from Medicare.
As well as a shower boot.
Yes. Thank you. That way everybody knows what the charges are and, you know, what's up front. So it's been moved and seconded that case number 19-43-C be dismissed if there are no violations of state statutes. We've had discussion. Is there any more discussion or comments? So we'll take a vote. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. You have a right.
she's not here, obviously. Okay. All right, our next case is 19-41-C, which is Dr. Serena Yoza. Dr. Yoza is not present. Our investigator is Dr. Polakoff. We do have the complainant present, and we will have opportunity for the complainants to speak after Dr. Polakoff gives her report. And I will remind the complainants that we refer to you by your initials. And I believe that LK, you are the wife of the complainant, but you made the complaint. So we'll refer to you by LK. So Dr. Polakoff, your investigation report.
Good morning, Board. This is Dr. Polakoff on 1941C, Serena Yoza, DPM. The Board received a complaint against Dr. Yoza from the wife of patient AK. LK made the complaint concerning the patient's long and arduous treatment for wound care. The patient originally had a ulcer on the plantar lateral aspect of the fifth metatarsal weight-bearing surface from, I believe, August of 2018. The patient was seen by Dr. Zonas and treated for the ulcer. In October of 2018, Dr. Zonas referred the patient for wound care to Dr. Yoza for this wound, which was not healing. The patient had many treatments by Dr. Yoza at the wound care clinic and also at her private office for the wound, with extensive documentation, care plans, medications used, etc., noted in the chart. In review of the records, the patient was referred on October of 2018. A vascular consult was ordered October 31st of 2018, and Dr. Yoza suggested the patient see Dr. Haddad, and the patient and his wife did not follow up with the vascular consult on a timely basis. They were advised that the cost of some of the medications, such as Santyl and more expensive medications, would be needed to treat this wound. The wound, unfortunately, was a weight-bearing area of the fifth metatarsal base, and the patient, even though he was observed with a walker, was also observed walking on directly onto this wound. He had several falls, and he had multiple comorbidities. In review, the vascular supply was extremely diminished, the neurological supply diminished, ischemic changes were noted, no ascending cellulitis were noted on many visits. The musculoskeletal exam was noted multiple times to have a bony promise of the left proximal styloid process of the fifth laterally. Radiographically, the fifth left metatarsal showed irregular patterns with radiolucency at the metatarsal, diaphyseal, and metaphyseal junction. Unable to order MRI because of his pacemaker, but a CT was ordered, which did show one moment, please. There are no signs of osteomyelitis, but there were advanced signs of osteoporosis. The patient had an ulcer of the left since August on the styloid process. He was in wound care. He was prescribed Granix, which does cost $200 per month. And this was not obtainable by the patient. The patient was encouraged by Dr. Yannis to purchase the product because, as she felt, it was the best one at that time. She did contact the Tenex company and performed a procedure from Tenex. I did write on the report what Tenex is and the procedure for this procedure. The purpose of the Tenex is to irritate the bone, remove some of this tissue, revascularize the area by the ultrasonic waves, and allow it to heal without overt surgical incision. The Tenex procedure was performed. Unfortunately, the patient hired a home health nurse, which removed the bandage the next day, which you're not supposed to do with the Tenex, which ruined the Tenex procedure. The patient unfortunately fell and fractured his elbow. He was hospitalized for the surgical procedure for the elbow, which did allow his foot to heal just a little bit while he was off weight-bearing in the hospital. He was admitted to an extended care facility to help off-weight load the area. Unfortunately, the end result was a partial amputation of the fifth ray, including the styloid process. The patient, as you see here today, is in a wheelchair, and this was a very unfortunate procedure with a high comorbidity. I found the violation for unsubstantiated with no state statutes violated.
No, I don't.
Initially, she had it was ordered a vascular study on October 1st. When was the was it ever done, performed? Did he ever get it performed?
No, it was finally performed when he was hospitalized for the fractured elbow months later.
Okay. And how was his blood sugar and diabetes?
They were elevated. There was some contention that which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did the elevated blood sugars cause delay in healing of the styloid process ulceration, or did the styloid process ulceration contribute to the diabetes, which caused the delay? So was it the diabetes that caused it, which the doctors advised the patient to watch his blood sugars because that could cause delayed healing? And the patient, which I do understand, and the patient's wife state that because of the elevated blood sugars that the doctor was referring to, it is not the cause of the ulcer. The ulcer irritated the blood sugars. So they're under that belief, and doctors under the belief, chicken or the egg, they're both contributed to it.
Dr. Polakoff, the complainant alleges that she asked many times that the ulcer be excised, and in wound care, that aggravates the situation, and wanted your comments on that.
The ulcer was under the styloid process, which is the complete weight bearing of the lateral fifth. You can't go in and excise that because then the weight bearing will be just slightly distal or slightly proximal. Wherever you excise, it's going to be more weight bearing to the area. So the treatment plan for this was to do anything you can to off-weight load the area, advising the patient not to walk on it, controlling the medical comorbidities that might affect it, controlling the blood supply that might affect it, etc. So unfortunately, of all the places that you can have the worst place to have an ulcer, it's the styloid process where this gentleman had it. And the styloid process is so important in balance that it was noted several times and the patient fell because balancing on this area is quite difficult. And when you are unsteady and using a walker, you abduct and you end up walking right on the styloid process.
And if I'm remembering that there was varus foot deformity anyway and that there had been an AFO, was it for that side, for that primary purpose
yes,
of trying to offload that before? Did he have that before he came to see
Dr. Zonas? Tried
Dr.
everything
Zonas
he could
him.
To
okay.
offload the area as well.
And the other thing is I noticed on the pathology report from the surgery that was done by
Dr. Stein.
Stein, that it shows there is no evidence of osteomyelitis in that fifth metatarsal or a portion of the cuboid, correct?
That is correct. Unfortunately, the osteopenic nature of the bone, the thinness of the bone and the weight bearing and the age and the comorbidities had diminishing structure and healing abilities to the area. Dr. Jonas was very good about the proper antibiotics and cleansing protocol of the area, which prevented the osteomyelitis from getting into the area quicker.
And I think, you know, it's in wound management, it's, you know, you can put any and do any of the more, you know, state-of-the-art procedures, dressings, but if you don't, if you can't offload the area, you're, for lack of a better term, you're doomed to having that fail. So it's the very basics, and of course with the blood sugar. So. Mr. Rhodes, do you have questions for Dr. Polakoff? Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. Now, sir, like I said, your spouse was the one who submitted the complaint, so I don't have the initial. What's his initial?
His name is AK.
AK, okay. So we will, yes, AK, and then, so, sir,
LK,
you can come up here to the desk with your chair, and then give us your summary of your complaint.
Could I perhaps add to some of what she discovered?
Yes, sir. That's yes. You let us know information that you think we need to hear. Yes.
I really don't hear very well. I brought with me a letter which I think summarizes the entire process from beginning
just
to
one
end.
Second.
From beginning to end. And I do have some extra copies. I didn't think there were going to be this many people, so I'll leave you what I have and then copies of your machine on here somewhere. But anyhow, I'd like to cover all through this letter. It's only a couple pages, so it won't take me long. With what we have brought today, we have the records from Honor Health, and this it's on a disc here. Like and they said, it's 360 pages long. I don't know how that could be, but we'll leave that with you if somebody wants to review it. Starting basically at the beginning, I had the unfortunate experience of developing a diabetic ulcer in late August of 2018. After a brief period of treatment from Dr. Zornson Scottsdale, we were referred to the wound center at Honor Health Osborne location. That's the last time we saw Dr. Zonas. We did not see him after October 31st of 2018. Once we got down to Honor Health, we were met with Dr. Zona, and we suggested she started treated at that point. Many times we suggested that she simply remove the procedure, and it's basically right on that bone. I'm sure that there's a word for it that I don't understand, but everybody has one of them there. Okay, we asked her just to cut it off because at that time it wasn't that bad. This was denied because Dr. Joseph felt that it was not the most, easiest way, effective procedure for doing this. During the time we were with Dr. Zona, we received several topical and oral medications, none of which were effective. At one point, we even asked if we could try the hydrobaric. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. It's the tube that they fill with air and they put you in it. But that was also denied. The procedure she had in mind was called Tenex, and I heard the doctor mention it. We were informed by Dr. Yoza that the procedure was relatively new and was approved by the FDA in 2012. Now, we had no way of verifying this, but that's what we were told. Having no other options available to us, we did proceed with Dr. Yoza's recommendation. And that, as far as the Tenex go, unfortunately, this procedure turned out to be an epic failure. It required a skin graft from my inner thymus. If you wanted to stand up and look, you could see it. It's right here across my leg. It's very obvious if you're standing up, you could see it. And she also indicated that it was going to be done pro bono, as it wasn't covered by her Medicare insurance. We recently learned that Dr. Yoza billed both Medicare and our secondary policy for both procedures, and we're not sure how much it was, but it was billed. And we were told by Dr. Yoza that she had performed this procedure many times. We became suspicious of that many times when the PA, who was with us at every call that we met with her, told us that this was the first and only time she had ever witnessed Dr. Yoza performing this procedure. So I don't know if this is the first one she ever did or if it's the 100th one and she wasn't telling us. But anyhow, on December 10th of that year, and this is, like I said, we've been through Dr. Yoza at the beginning, and then I was back out. And what I had, there was due to an unhealed ulcer in my left foot, I fell and shattered my left elbow. Now I have two plates and 18 screws in this elbow. And the guy did a pretty good job. I mean, I could get it out there pretty good. It clicks a little bit. The movement's not too bad. I have two steel plates and 18 screws. It required a hospital stay of 19 days in Honor Health and Arcadia Rehab Center. Once we were done with that, we went back to getting treatments with the wound center, and we asked Dr. Yoza again to surgically remove that, and she said no, and the reason she was denying at this point, it's the first time we had to mention it, was that my A1C was too high, just making the procedure too risky. She was constantly criticizing my diet for the high A1C. Now, she's the only one that was having a problem with this because all my other doctors, including my diabetic doctor, said the reason that your A1C is high, and it wasn't like 8, it was 7-something, they felt that it was due to the foot infection and not to my diet. I mean, over a period of a couple of years, I've lost quite a bit of weight, but I'm not, you know, I'm pretty good about my diet. I followed pretty well. Like I said, once we returned home after that, and then we came back, foot kept getting worse and worse, and it eventually had spread throughout my left foot. During this hospital, I did receive hydrobaric treatment, which had previously been denied by Dr. Yoza, and it was Dr. Stein who was recommending this. And recently, had not seen Dr. Yoza now. I was only seeing Dr. Stein. And he performed the surgery. It got so bad that he ended up performing the surgery, and he cut, and I think she explained it, from here back to the heel. So this left side is basically gone. The heel is still there, but it's right in front of it, and all the way down. I guess my intent here is her lack of care resulted in an unnecessary surgery and a permanent disability and a reduction in my quality of life. My big problem now is not pain, what I'm having to do with them, and I'm going to rehab twice a week now working on this, is balance. My balance is terrible. I mean, if I put the wheelchair down and tried to walk across over to there, I'd fall. I wouldn't make it. Well, maybe, but I'm lucky if I made it that far. So really, I can't do a damn thing without this wheelchair. And, I just think that she's the cause of why this thing got so bad and why the surgery even had to be done. Because if she'd take care of it sooner, like we had talked about, that we would never have the surgery, and I'd never have this wheelchair. I know that as far as has this cost me anything, I recently was just looking to do some part-time work, and I used to play a lot of golf, I'm interested in golf, and I talked to the different golf courses out where I live, and one of them actually said, you know, I got a job that would be wonderful for you. He says, I'm afraid I don't think you can do it, because we cannot deal with the wheelchair. And it was basically working at the golf course. And if I'd been able to get that job, it would have been for part-time work. You know, I wouldn't be interested in doing full-time. I couldn't do full-time. About $1,500 a month. So, you know, that's $18,000 a year, and I don't know how many years you could work there, probably 10 years. Maybe that would be the outside. I wouldn't work for part of that, but at least five. If you add that $18,000 a year times 5 years, that's $90,000. And that's the money I didn't get, and I'll never get now because of that. And that's why I'm kind of pissed about the whole thing. You know, if they had taken care of it when we thought she should have, I wouldn't have these problems. So I've fallen. I'm embarrassed to tell you how many times I've fallen. I mean, it's pushing 100. And the only time I ever broke anything was this, and this was bad. It just shattered the arm. Into it. So that's basically how I see it. I don't know if much difference in what you saw. No. Oh, that's right.
And the delay in seeing Dr. Haddad is because of the fall and
right.
His being laid up between the hospital. The rehab center from the 10th of December until sometime very late December over January. So we did see Dr. Haddad. He did testing for the circulation, but it was delayed because of the fall.
And when we saw him, he said that the circulation is fine. There was no issues as far as he was concerned.
Sir, what date did you say that fall was where you broke your arm again? What was the date?
December 10th, 2018.
And when did you first start to see Dr. Yosa?
October 31st. It was Halloween day, I remember that. And when I fell, I was in the hospital the rest of the year. I think I got out the 29th. And I get, you know, and unfortunately, of course, am I left or right-handed? Of course, I'm left-handed. What else would it be?
How long have you been diabetic, sir?
30 years.
So diagnosed in 2001.
And I had it before that. That was 20 years ago, and I had it before that. We really didn't do much about it. And we pretty much keep it under control. I see a Dr. Leilani and a couple. I've got some very, very good physicians as part of my group that I call on out in the Fountain Hills area.
So how would you indicate what's normal for you for your blood sugar range and your A1Cs?
Low sevens, 7.1. Sometimes it'll
go. Do you do a stick every day? How many times a day do you check your sugar? Do you do it daily or?
I check it at least once daily at the same time every morning, and now depending upon how I feel. I used to feel that I was running low. I don't feel that anymore, but I do take a fairly substantial dose of diabetic medication.
What do you think your average range
is? Pardon me? The average blood sugar is probably, I'd say 120 to 125. Now, I'll give you an example. This morning it was 33. And that's kind of about average. Mm-hmm. And the doctors that I talk to say that I do keep a record of my weight, my blood sugar count, heart rate and everything, high blood pressure. And this morning it happened to be that. I know the blood pressure this morning was 124 over 19, which is, that's a little low. It's normally about 125 to 130 over 80.
Well, there's, you know, and two of the, you know, with the long-standing diabetes and the function of advancing maturity, you know, A1Cs are, you know, usually up a little bit, and you know, it's normal process of aging to, as we, each decade, I believe, you know, we can have our normal blood sugars are a little higher, so.
Yeah, they said.
If your internist was not, you know, wasn't alarmed by things.
No. By God, believe it or not, they lowered the cost of insulin January 1st. My insulin went from just under 300 to just under 100. I mean, it's a third of what it used to be. unbelievable. That's the biggest single thing. I don't know how they, who was working on it, but I never heard it was going to change, but I was very happy to see that number. That reduction, and I had to switch over to Walgreens. Mm-hmm. That reduction alone makes up for all the smaller increases in about my other medications. So I'm pretty happy about that.
I do want to know, why were you, what was the impetus of you hiring your own home health nurse?
Well, they actually hired them for us. We didn't go out and actually hire them.
Okay. So that was set up by...
By,
when,
I don't know.
When he left Acacia, which is where he was, they set it up to help keep him off of the support.
They were there for, 2 months maybe.
That's how long you were at Acacia, at the rehab?
No, yeah, that's why I started off at Honor Health where they set it and kept it there four or five days. And then I went to Honor Health for about Acacia for about 2 weeks. And when leaving Acacia and returning home is when they had these compass insurance in the home health care.
So now you have a diabetic shoe and an insert in your shoe?
Yes. Okay. I mean, I have like this pair of shoes are diabetic shoes, and they were prescribed by Dr. Jonas, and I have more than one pair. They're all exactly the same shoe in different colors. They feel good, and this pair happens to be black, but I also have a couple other pairs like red.
Were you given any instructions when you left Honor Health for the initial 10X procedure? Did they give you, like, post-op instructions, a sheet to go home with? Did they tell you not to be walking on your foot?
Oh, yeah. This whole period of time, beginning way back is in October, I've always been told to stay off as much as you can. And I try to do that. It's kind of hard to stay off it entirely. And most of the time when I'm out, I have this, and because we're not sure how far it was, and I also have a walker. This would be a long walk for my walker. The legs give out before that. Nobody ever said to me what that treatment was going to do.
What?
Dr. Yoza didn't really leave us any post-operative instructions on the 10X procedure. And then Dr. Sein... I'm not sure if he gave us any instructions on after he removed part of the foot.
I think that part of the reason for the home health was to monitor what was going on with the ulcer.
Right.
And they came usually twice a week to change the bandages.
That's basically all they did.
And they were monitoring the degree of the infection. We suspected there was infection, but never realized that the infection got to the bone, which caused the partial infection.
But you're aware that the pathology report that was received when Dr. Stein did the surgery, there was no evidence of infection in the bone that was removed. And
tell us there was then. They said that was the reason for the surgery, that the bone had become infected.
Well, that was their initial impression, because when they saw, you know, your x-rays and stuff and the way the bone looked, it can, you know, bone can be degenerated for a lot of different reasons. And when you see it on a radial, on an x-ray or an MRI or a CT, you can have a lot of things that it could be. So that's why it's kind of the gold standard in diagnosing infection in the bone is taking a sample and having it analyzed.
Now they took this sample the day of the surgery?
Yes, sir. Yeah, when they took the bone out.
Yeah,
that was sent to the pathologist.
Why did they do the surgery then if they...
Well, there was
no infection.
Another question I have for you is, Beek, I noticed when you had your preoperative discussion with Dr. Stein,
you were given other options because of, particularly in light of your multiple health issues that you have with the diabetes and the falls, and I believe you have a cancer diagnosis, that the options they gave you were, I believe, was continual wound care, the surgery, and pardon me if I need to ask Dr. Polakoff, there was one other option on there. I'm trying to get to my page where I know this is on the information that was presented from Honor Health regarding the surgery. Because it is my memory serves me that the option for surgery was agreed upon.
Oh, yeah, it was.
But that Dr. Stein had given you other options.
What were the other options? Because I don't recall any of them being viable. I mean, they mentioned there were other possible cures, but the one that they basically ended and centered on was we need to take it off because the infection got down to the bone. That was what we were led to believe. And it had to occur because it got to the bone. And now you're saying that the bone was infected?
That's what the pathology report that we have says.
Well, I thought that was, I mean, that's why they did what they did. They took the bone, the surgery was to take the bone out. And when they took that out on the inside, it obviously would have taken the infection with it. But now you're saying that there wasn't one. That's the first time I've ever heard that.
There was infection. Pathology shows that you had complete resection of the left fifth toe, went down to the metatarsal, was biopsied, and was free of infection.
This is after the surgery?
Well, this was during the surgery that was done, yeah.
Well, this is the first time we've heard of this.
I've never heard that before.
What page is that, Kim?
Dr. Polakoff, do you have the page number on that pathology?
I don't have pages corresponding to what.
We don't have the pathology report. I've never seen it.
Prior to seeing Dr. Zonis, did you fall?
Yeah, but I haven't seen him since we went from the time we discovered this, and I happened to be out of the state at the time. It was just a few days when we got back, we got in to see Zonis. We saw him until Halloween, 10/31/18. I have not seen him since then.
Yeah, prior to seeing Dr. Zonis, did you develop a callus? Prior to the sore around the bottom
no,
of your
No, it wasn't
fit.
A callus. It was a red.
So it just developed right away?
It broke open. And we had a pad on it. Had a pad on it all the time until after the surgery. Then we took it off.
I'm talking prior to surgery.
Yeah, we had a pad on it.
Okay. And was it sore at all in that area? It just developed.
That's when it hurt. See, it doesn't hurt now. I mean, that's when the pain was. It was an ugly looking thing. That big, maybe. You couldn't really wear shoes or anything with it.
Was there a bony prominence underneath
yeah.
that you were walking on? And when you saw Dr. Zonis the first time for that sore, was it already open? And
I think it was already open. But that was, I mean, and I saw him very quickly after this developed.
Okay.
So not a long time. I mean, it wasn't more than a week. And I can tell you the exact date it was because I was at a family reunion. And that morning is when it broke open. And then, you know, got back here to Phoenix and Dr. Zonas.
The other thing, Dr. Zonas had health issues on his own and kind of difficult to get appointments with him because his treatments were out of state. And that is why he thought it best if we got to the board.
Dr. Polakoff just gave me on her report that the options that Dr. Stein had discussed was the debridement of that lateral or the outside aspect of your foot. And again, like I said, since they were with the multiple medical issues, allowing just treatment of the wound with chronic antibiotic management and local wound care without, you know, anticipation of a cure or the amputation of the fifth toe and the metatarsal, and again, that was the option that was selected. So let me.
Do you remember Dr. Stein giving options to the surgery? I don't either. I mean, we were under the understanding that was the only thing that would really work. I mean, we could keep trying the other things that we tried salves and we tried antibiotics and we tried this, the tenex operation. We tried a bunch of things, and none of them worked. It never got any better. It just kept getting worse. And this would be between 10/31/18 and 5/31/19. That was the time we were under the care of Dr. Yoza. And prior to that was Dr. Zonas. And Dr. Zonas has been my foot doctor for many years. I've been seeing him for about 10 years. It's taken me about 20 years here in the Phoenix area to finally get doctors I'm happy with. Happy with me, I guess. Anybody know how he's doing, by the way?
He's also my doctor.
Pardon me?
He's also my podiatrist.
How's he doing? I mean, with his issue, he's doing okay? I'm going to give him a call next week, and it has really doesn't have anything to do with this. It has to do with the nails. They need to be trimmed, and it's much better that he does it than if I try and do it. I can do it, and I can get every one of them to bleed.
Were you ever offered to be put in a total contact cast?
I'm sorry.
Did Dr. Yoza ever present to you the possibility of a total contact cast to offload your foot and heal that ulcer?
I'm sure I don't. I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Your foot in a cast.
Oh, no.
That was never an option. Because I was with him at all the appointments.
Yeah, you did
to get him in there.
It says acute osteo.
I know on his reports, but they.
I couldn't find the other report.
Yeah, I'm looking for it because it was after they, you know, they demineralized the bone
right.
And everything that they said there was no evidence of the osteomyelitis. Dr. Polakoff, can you address to that the issue about billing Medicare for the
Tenex, yeah.
On the Tenex.
We were told that she was going to do it pro bono, and then we later were told by the PA that she had billed them. I did not see how much she billed them.
But well, the Tenex, actual physical Tenex device was pro bono. Mm-hmm. I think that's what she meant.
Okay.
That unit, most of the surgery centers do not cover that unit for Medicare patients. So that's what I think she meant by pro bono with
okay, yeah, the device itself.
The device itself.
Not the surgery, the physical.
Right.
Well, apparently she billed the surgery. And her PA, who would have no reason to tell us anything different, said that, first of all, we were told that she had done this surgery many, hundreds of times. Well, okay, it's not hundreds of times, but the PA said that's the first and only time I've ever seen her do it. And it to our knowledge, she seemed to be with her all the time. Every time she did anything, she was there. Now, why would she tell us that? You know, we were told that she had done it hundreds of times, and Dr. Stein, to our knowledge, did not give us any other options. That's why we went with him.
She talked about the attendance procedure from, like, the second appointment. She was determined that was the solution, and she, everything else, she wouldn't even consider.
Well, I tend to believe that she was trying to do the best for you. You know, looking at her documentation and things, and she is a specialized, you know, advanced wound care specialist. So she's a, you know, trying to use all the things that she can do to help heal a wound, because they are very difficult, and it's a, you know, it's a situation that's fraught with a lot of angst and trying to help people and do, you know, do the right thing and try to offer the best that you can. So, okay, here is what we do have here. Final diagnosis from your surgery that was performed on 5/31/19 with Dr. Stein. The final diagnosis is the left fifth toe, so that's your little pinky toe, had acute osteomyelitis, but the left cuboid and the metatarsal says it's negative for osteomyelitis. So you did have it in the toe, but not in the metatarsal. But in order to make sure that there wasn't any advancement of that osteomyelitis, that's why the recommendation to remove the ray. What did your, was your little fifth toe ever red and swollen or pussy or anything?
Okay. No, the only mark was, you call that thing, halfway up the side of your foot. And the bones stick. If you put your foot down, it just would stick out a little bit.
Yeah.
And at that time, we were already wearing diabetic shoes.
Dr. Polakoff was there. There was that plantar exostosis, but that was not part of discussion for removing that exostosis, or am I?
From the understanding.
Larger hole, and then either proximal or distal to
that site, you're going to have weight there. I have no other questions. No. As we all know, I mean, diabetes is such an unforgiving illness, and putting on top of that, you know, pedal deformities and increased pressure. And like we said, you know, there are so many different kinds of wound care products and procedures that you can do that, you know, you go through a, you know, your, whatever your protocol or your algorithm is for treating things. And the fact that there was good blood flow, which we finally found out, and that's why I was trying to ascertain here, too, because from what I was getting from the records, there was a 5-month period of time before the consult was done. The claimant is reporting that they had the fall, and that's being in the hospital for the arm. But I thought that fracture came much later. So this time issue, I want to be clear.
The 3 dates you're talking about is when we first went to first appointment to see Dr. Yoza, it was 10/31/18. It happened to be Halloween. That's why I remember the date. And then she treated us until, I would say,
early December.
And then I took the fall in December, and then I was in rehab and fixing up this elbow. Once we finished the elbow, I went back home, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And in the meantime, we were still seeing Dr. Yoza. We did not see Dr. Stein until about the 1st of May, maybe. And after we saw Dr. Stein, we did not see Dr. Yoza anymore. So that we were not seeing two doctors at the same time. Dr. Zonas prior to 10/31/18. Dr. Zona from 10/31/18 to about 5/1/19, and then at 5/31/19, we went to Dr. Stein from 5/1, and then we went to the surgery with 5/31/19.
He was admitted to the hospital in Osborne the Friday of Memorial Day.
And Dr. Polakoff, the at the initial office visit of Dr. Yosa, she recommended that consult at that time. Okay, so she recommended it several times. So my question at that point, when you first saw Dr. Yosa and she instructed, asked for this referral to Dr. Haddad, it wasn't done then, and then you had the fall on the 10th of December. So what happened between that initial visit and the fall, that why you didn't do the consult then?
I'm sorry, why didn't we see a doctor between 10/31?
Right, when Dr.
Dad?
Yosa had asked, had directed you to have that referral to Dr. Haddad, the interventional.
And we did eventually get to see him. He was very, very busy, and it just took a long time to get an appointment. I don't know. You forgot about what the date of his.
Okay, just trying to make sure.
I don't remember when we saw him, but we just saw him the one time. He took the test, and he came back. That was it.
Okay.
So from day one, all she talked about was the
Mark. Well, she's not here to talk, but I think Dr. Yosha wanted to try to fix it via minimal intervention.
Right.
So the 10X procedure is a little, it's an 11 blade, it's a very little incision site, and go and clean up the area. And that's why she wants to do that. It is used a lot for wound care to try to remove some superficial bone over the wound site without having to create a big incision.
And I think we understand that, but now where does it come in? She said she's done hundreds of these, and her PA said she's only done one.
I can't answer for that, and she's not here to answer, so I don't know.
I mean,
about that, but,
yeah.
10X has been out for years, so I'm sure she's done more than one, but she's not here to answer.
Yeah.
I don't see any deficit in state statute.
I don't either. It's, you know, like I said, this and the disease process is very unfortunate. Nobody has any, you know, there's so much of that we have no control over. People do their best to try to take care of folks. And I think, you know, she was efficient in trying to get you to the right people and address issues appropriately and in a timely fashion. And that's what we're here to determine is, you know, was any of our statutes violated in her performance of care for you?
I didn't see any.
No, I think this is very unfortunate, and you know, that the wound was like it was, but I see no violation of state statute, and I would move to dismiss 1941C as finding no violation of state statute.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Thank you for your time. We appreciate you coming in.
Do you want a copy of this?
I believe we have it, and Heather will keep it in the file.
Why did she not want to do the surgery?
She's not here. We couldn't have asked those questions, and since we've adjudicated the case, we can't discuss any more things. Gentlemen, I'd like to take a 10-minute break. Thank you so much. Okay, we are back on record. Our next Investigation file is 19-32-C. Dr. Keith Banger, DPM. Our investigators, Dr. Polakoff. Dr. Bangard is present with his counsel, William Sauters. And we also have our complainant, TT, who is present. So we will first hear from Dr. Polakoff,
Good morning, Board. It's Dr. Polakoff on 1932C, and I do apologize. I did make one typo of the number on the report, but the bottom has the correct number of 1932C. This is a complaint received by the Board from patient TT concerning the improper quality of care practices provided by Dr. Bangert. On October 25th, 2016 through June 20th, 2017, an eight-month period, Dr. Bangert treated TT with steroid injections, 11 of them total, which caused tissue and ligament of the foot to be very compromised. The patient had pain to her second intermetatarsal space left with a positive Molnar's click, according to Dr. Bangert's record in November of 2016. She had a mild deviation of the second toe and new pain to the third interspace right with a positive Molnar's click. From the very first treatment of October 25th, 2016, through the last treatment, injections were offered by Dr. Bangert and other therapies. The patient was given appropriate set of Spenco over-the-counter orthotics. She was given on October 25th, 2016, an injection of the second interspace left of Kenalog 10 milligrams and dexamethasone 1 milligram. The next almost 2 weeks, just shy of November 9th, 2016, injections were given to the right interspace. And they're on the fourth page of the report. I do have a chart that shows the number of injections given to the second interspace left, third toe left area, second right, and third right for a total of the 11 injections. The patient had surgery from Dr. Bangert in the past, and on August 4th of 2017, there was pain to bilateral second toes, which were drifting, and they had been getting cortisone injections. She used the orthotics purchased from another doctor's office and Vionic shoes. She has a history of the right bunion several years ago for surgery, but both caused pain, numbness, and tingling to the interspaces and the toes. TT noticed drifting of the second toes and a positive Thompson test. The film show bad dislocation of bilateral second of the right toe greater than left. And in the past, surgery noted second met on the left was shortened, right second toe is much longer, and the base of the left first and second mets are gapped with arthritic changes, suspected of an old Lisfranc injury. These are all from the records of the following physician, Dr. Galley. Just 1 second. My contention on this case is the number of injections given by Dr. Bangert to this patient with the Kenalog and dexamethasone, 10 milligrams and 1 milligram. The doctor's attorney submitted three articles for us to review. And the first article, Injection Corticosteroids in Modern Practice. This article I read it completely. It's about intra-articular injections have been shown to be safe for repeated use every 3 months for up to 2 years. If you look at the flow chart that I made of the doctor's injections, the patient had much more frequent injections into a small space. The patient is petite. She has, from her stature, not excessive fat pad for the steroid to absorb. And it is my contention that the sequela of the dislocated toes, the tendon disruption, and the pain were caused by the repeated injections, which is substantiated by the article that was given to me by his attorney. The second article by his attorney was skin depigmentation following local cortisone injections for interdigital neuromas. That occurs, but it's not the problem that we're having today for the pain and separation, dislocation of movement of the toes secondary to the injection. And the third article that was given to me to review reviewed the crystalline forms of different steroid injections. The patient did end up having more surgery by Dr. Galley for a preoperative diagnosis of painful first metatarsal hardware, right foot, which was removed, right second plantar plate tear repair, right third plantar plate tear repair, subluxation of right second metatarsal phalangeal joint repair, and right second intermetatarsal neuroma repair and removal. In the allegation of harm to the public for improper quality of care practices, injections of right foot with too many steroid injections, I found that this was substantiated.
Is there anything in the notes that Dr. Bangar warned the patient about possible plantar plate tears or any kind of negative qualities of doing steroid shots?
I cannot recall offhand if there were, but I'm sure that Dr. Bangar, who's been practicing for a short time now, probably has told the patient. But in my opinion, it's not that the patient warns you could get this. It's the onus of the doctor. You should know how many injections you should give. You should know that there is a limit. You should know by the size, shape, and stature of the patient that she had a very skinny foot. And the patient's here today. She can show you her foot, and you can see the sunken in areas of the intermetatarsal areas, the prominent tendons, the dislocations and deviations of the toes. So it's the doctor's onus to know enough's enough.
With the steroid injections, is it in your opinion that it gives an accelerated degeneration of the tendon and the capsule surrounding that area where the shot was given?
It has a lot of sequela, and that's part of it. Not all of it, but that's part of it.
And that article, I think it was 2005, was it?
That is correct.
It's about 15 years ago.
And the article just substantiates the claim of intra-articular injections have been shown to be safe for repeated use every 3 months for up to 2 years. If you notice the frequency of the injections, it was almost every 2 weeks. For 10:25 to 10:09 to 11:22, 1:04, 1:18, 2:16, that's a month, 6:06, 6:20, 5:15, and you can see the frequency.
And some of the other, back to, the articles, again, like Dr. Yolano indicated, that's 2005 is an older article, and this was geared towards osteoarthritis or rheumatoid arthritis, intra-articular injections in a large joint. They're aspirating to, to study the, what the fluid is. And so it's like trying to compare apples to oranges, because the article goes on to state that periarticular injections, which is what an intermetatarsal neuroma injection would be, there's not a, you know, the effects of those kind of steroids in non-articular areas is not well understood, which they noted back then. And Dr. Polakoff ended that the other was kind of an anecdotal case about someone that developed a different kind of side effect to having the steroid injections. So, you know, a lot of recent articles that have been written in like Podiatry Management or Podiatry Today discuss this issue of plantar plate tears, particularly, you know, looking back at the body mechanics, that it's, you know, it's more common in females, and it's the second metatarsal head. Most of the time there's a bunion deformity. And of course, in this case, we realized that the bunion deformity had been corrected, but you have a long second metatarsal, and that second metatarsal is going to be under a lot of stress. Again, if a patient has an atrophic plantar fat pad, and all the things that we understand and realize, that that's now they're showing that most people that are having these plantar plate tears have had a couple of steroid injections within a short period of time. And Dr. Polakoff, a question I had regarding the surgery where the performance of the Weil osteotomy with the condylectomies. And what do you think about, there was a condylectomy of the lateral aspect of the right third metatarsal head and the medial aspect of the right second metatarsal to decompress the nerve, which was found not to be inflamed.
Correct.
But then the Weil was done. So wouldn't that decrease the inherent stability of a Weil when you've taken a portion of the metatarsal head off?
Yes, and subsequent to that, documented by both the Dr. Bangert, Dr. Galley, and the patient, the toes started to seriously deviate.
Mr. Rhodes, did you have any questions?
There's been so much conjecture over the use of steroids and the injections that, you know, I'm going to refer to you guys on the professionalism for the injections.
Right, and because it is. It has become a very controversial subject. And I know a lot of physicians now really shy away from doing them and try to find other options for treating. Okay. So we may have other questions for Dr. Polakoff later. So we will ask our complainant TT if she can approach the front table. And ma'am, remember we have to refer to you by your initials. Once you'll give your summary and then we can have time to ask questions of you. Okay.
Okay. I was wanting to speak if there were any questions from me. I feel that everything is well documented in what I submitted in Dr. Bangert's notes.
Did Dr. Bangert discuss with you possible side effects or complications from receiving cortisone injection?
No, he did not.
Had you had any experience with having injections, cortisone injections anywhere else in your body for any issues?
Had cortisone injections before.
Now, before you got that first injection on, what's the date here? Hang on a second. That would have been on your initial visit of 10/25 of 16. Dr. Bangert took x-rays that day. Did you have the injection before or after the x-rays were taken?
I can't recall.
At that initial visit too, did you indicate that you had any, did you notice or did anyone say anything about the fat pad on the ball of your foot? Was it thin or pulled up towards the toes or anything like that? And then prior to your surgery, did Did Dr. Bangart perform a history, a full history and physical exam on you? Did he listen to your heart or your lungs or anything?
When did you notice the toe starting to drift over?
I noticed the toe starting to drift over probably a month before I stopped seeing Dr. Bangart. My right foot really swelled up, and I noticed the toe drifting over.
How are you doing now, ma'am?
I'm in pain quite often. I can't do what I normally do. I used to hike 5-6 days a week. I don't do any of that anymore. There's not a lot that I can do with my because of my foot. I can't wear the shoes I used to wear, can't do the things I used to do. So that's very upsetting to me.
And are you still under the care of Dr. Galley?
I am, yes.
And you had two surgeries with her, correct?
Yes.
Did those surgeries give you a percentage of relief?
A little bit of relief, yes. She has told me that I'm going to end up having to possibly have joint replacements in my foot.
Pardon me?
She's has told me that I'm possibly going to end up having to have joint replacements in my foot.
Did she tell you where in your foot?
No.
And prior to you having surgery and the injections also, were you offered any other conservative management for your pain?
No.
Did you do anything else yourself to try to relieve the pain in the foot?
Elevating it, heat and ice.
All right, Mr. Souders.
Right.
We can then begin with Dr. Bangart giving us a summary of the case from his point of view.
Could I address some things? This is William Souders.
Yes, please.
And thank you. Congratulations on your award, Dr. Campbell.
Thank you very much.
I'll go a little bit out of order, but I think if I can address some things that I heard from Dr. Polakoff and not so much TT. And if we look at the October 25th, 2016 record to address the issue of perhaps what the board was getting at, informed consent, on page 103 on the 10-25-16 note, Dr. Bangart charts, I discussed this problem in detail and dispensed informative literature. The first course of treatment involves a series of 3 steroid injections about 2 weeks apart. I feel patient has a 90% chance of successful resolution with this treatment. So I think the record does address the issue of was this discussed with the patient prior to undertaking these therapies. I think the answer. Yes. Now, Dr. Bangert's much better at discussing the issue of frequency of injections and also the concentrations of injections. He understands that both the frequency and the concentration with all patients, especially this patient, and he'll get into that. But I think there was discussion of 1 cc of Kenalog. Well, it's actually a half cc was what was being administered, so that's half the dosage. The I heard discussion of the articles, and those were in fact submitted by me, but those were selected and were reviewed by Dr. Bangert and his staff, and he can really discuss those articles far better than I can. But I think what's important to understand is, as much as this treatment, I would contend on behalf of Dr. Bangert that this treatment was suitable for this patient, and certainly in this practitioner's mind, in the best interest of the patient. There's not a lot of information out there on it, and that's why these articles were suggested or presented on the basis that at least they were peer-reviewed, and at least they were as on point as we could get to provide as one resource to this board. I think Dr. Bangert's treatment of TT has to be looked at from the whole, in the entire context of his education, residency, and what he's learned in his practice. And ultimately, while there's been an outcome that Dr. Galley subsequently has deemed to be the consequence of Dr. Bangert's treatment, the treatment was always in the best interest of the patient back in 2016. We're talking about something that happened a long time ago. But that being said, I think Dr. Bangert's best suited to really address any questions the board has. Thanks for listening.
So, again, with my treatment of patients, it's the same. I inform them. There's a green pamphlet that talks about neuromas. We talk about steroid injections. When she came in, she had bilateral foot pain. So I was treating both feet. I don't know if there was just some confusion. I've never done surgery on her right foot. Surgery was done on her left foot. I think even Dr. Pologoff had mentioned that I did her right foot as well. And so, so in the interim, when I go over the X-ray, I don't change. I think, you know, and how you do things as far as explaining, because if you do that, then you're all over the place as a practitioner. So my view on steroid therapy, corticosteroid therapy, is you do the least amount with the lowest dose to get a therapeutic effect without causing tissue damage. I feel that a half cc of Kenalog 10, which is 5 milligrams, and a half cc of dexamethasone 4 milligrams, which is 2 milligrams, and you space that out every 2 to 3 weeks, can give them the best chance of success. And this is something that I was taught in my training. Multiple other practitioners would do it, and a lot of my training, and as I was a student, we're using much higher concentrations. Again, that's why I gave that article of that skin atrophy one, because we know that happens. That was an injection of Kenalog 40. So much, much higher concentration in one injection. The goal, again, is to help them start to walk without pain. Then you can get them walking normal, because we know all this is, these are just symptoms of an abnormal biomechanics in the foot. The reason I gave that other article about the intra-articular steroid injections is because I did a long literature research with my brother's a resident, has access to search engines, and there's not a lot out there. There's a lot of anecdotal stuff. This was the one that had just, you know, at least saying, yes, there are complications, and they're also very effective based on the dosage you're using. I've never injected intra-articular on this patient, never injected into the second and third MPJs. Again, the reason of the last one showing the different half-lives and the strengths, if you look at the Kenalog one, which is the triamcinolone, I think it's the acetonide, has a 14-day half-life. So as you give, you know, again, that's the goal of getting them to get better. I always talk to them about biomechanics. I talk to them about, we got to get your pain better and then fix your foot. If you look at the, Dr. Kolakoff mentioned that there was 11 injections. They weren't all on that foot. Again, if you look at the total dosage of steroid over that 8-month time period, Kenalog was 40 to 40, it was 8 or 9, it was, so let's say 9, it was 45 milligrams. That's, you know, there's often times where that's one injection. The goal is to keep her foot feeling better as she was recovering from the surgery I performed on her left foot so she could walk. And I didn't just keep doing them because there was, you know, she was seeing improvement. And it came back again. So it wasn't like I was just doing injection after injection after injection from October until June. Again, the goal is to help them get better. And again, my thoughts on the steroid, again, if I didn't clarify that, again, I think we get caught up on the number. And that we know there's literature. There's nothing that talks about this is what you give them. This is it. There's, as far as frequency and recommendations, there's, you know, why do we always say three? It seems like three seems to get people better most of the time. If they don't get better, I don't keep giving them steroids. But I will, you know, if we go three and they do okay, and then it comes back in 3 or 4 months, and depending on how the foot's looking and how they're doing, and I mean, I take that into effect. And the fact they had success, I've seen people get better trying it again, and we avoid surgery and get them in shoes and off they go. Surgery is always the very last thing, unless there's a, you know, just something you gotta address, or the patient feels that they have exhausted that. So again, it's concentration, I think, which is to be taken into account with what number. You guys have any questions for me?
Sure. With your injections that you had with the TT, did she express any improvement after the succeeding injection?
So, again, this is, I mean, I, to my notes, yes, I don't remember that conversations at that time.
So you don't recall if she was getting better after your shot?
If looking through my notes, she was seeing improvement, yes.
Did she express at all any reservations about getting cortisone shots?
I can't recall that. I mean,
and then,
I have patients that don't want them, and I don't give them. But I, as far as her, no, I don't recall that. I couldn't give you a correct answer there.
I don't have any questions.
I would like to know about the lateral condylectomy of the left, pardon me, was an error in the field.
Okay.
That left second metatarsal head then with the performance of the while, mm-hmm. about stability of that area.
Sure. So, again, part of this goes back to my training. If, you know, looking at her x-ray, she had some medial deviation of the toe, but no, you know, again, so the while was to kind of try and realign that parabola. With in my training, and again, as I've seen throughout my practice on nerve decompression, whether it's in the tarsal tunnel or deep peroneal nerve or an aroma, more often than not, that nerve is normal looking. It's not always a thickened nerve. However, if we're still trying, you know, so what do we do in that procedure? You know, if you're going from a dorsal approach, once you get to that inner metatarsal ligament, you transect it to more better visualize the plantar nerve. If there is an area of, you know, again, there are times where it's a very, very tight space, I don't do it all the time, but if, you know, in these x-rays, if these, you know, the second, third metatarsal condyles are quite close and they're having neuroma type pain, I will decompress that area a little bit more, no different than anywhere else where there's a bony prominence where they're trying to take any further pressure off a nerve. As far as destabilizing the joint, again, if you're doing anything intracapsular, we do intra-articular surgery all the time on bunions. We don't worry. We take care to protect those collateral ligaments. We remove medial ligaments all the time, which is that condyle, and make efforts to protect that. I do the same on those procedures.
And then I have, my question regarding the surgical consult, where it's noted that, wasn't billed to that level, but that the description of the heart and the lungs and the abdomen. Did you actually do a full H&P on that patient?
I listen to heart and lungs. I check their neck. I look at their eyes. I have them. I do that every time. I haven't changed that since I was a resident.
So does your hospital not record? They take your... that is the history and physical, or do you have constraints with the hospital or your surgery center as far as the performance of this? You have to have their primary care does that and does a clearance?
No, I have the ability to do that because of the number of full HMPs I do in my residency training.
Yes, but where you do the procedures, what's the protocol at that?
They accept my HMPs, yes.
Dr. Galley said she had diagnosed she needed repairs for the steroid damage. Was there any damage that you feel was present prior to the injections?
Thank you.
Yeah, I have.
On the note of 118.17, he indicates that you discussed the plantar plate repair of the left second. So if you previously knew that your left second toe was already deviated, why did you inject that left second intermetatarsal space? Because the previous documentation on 1026, you did indicate there was no pain plantarly, but again, I go back to the biomechanics here. It's, as to when you're starting to already see drift, why did you give another injection? And were you not considering the possibility of a plantar plate rupture or tear? And I had forgotten to ask you, too, was at that initial visit, did you give the injection before you took the x-ray or after?
So, in regards to your first question about the, I don't know, I
I know.
That's not, that's not getting into the joint itself and directly affecting the planter plate. As far as my normal protocol for the x-rays, usually when a patient comes in, they have their x-rays. If we ask, okay, your foot hurting, which foot? We get the x-rays first, and then I see them. I look at the x-rays. I go over them, talk, you know, examine their foot.
And again, I note, okay, on your visit of 6/7/17, still concerned about the drifting of the toe.
On which? On the right foot?
Sorry,
I'm not at that note yet.
Well,
so.
You've given, yeah, that date you gave, well, the left second toe was, the drift was returning, and then the right second toe, there was also medial drift. And you, it indicated you expressed concern about the integrity of the soft tissue and the plantar plate of the second MPJ, but you went ahead and gave an injection into the right third interspace.
So, which one were you reading from again? Excuse me?
This is your visit of 6/7/17.
I think they're pages 1 of 3, 2 of 3, 3 of 3. It, can you see that at the bottom right-hand corner?
Okay, you're reading on page 2 of 3. I found it there. Okay. So what was your question again, Dr.
Like
Campbell?
I said, I would, you know, on that date, the patient's still concerned about the drifting of the toe. The diagnosis was the left second toe is returning its medial drift, the right second toe medial drift. MPJ pain, and you stated that you were, you expressed concern about the integrity of the soft tissue and the plantar plate of the second MPJ, but you went ahead and gave an injection into the right third. So were you talking about you were concerned about the left second or the right second?
Well, if I'm reading, again, I'm going off what I wrote here on the note. I don't recall that. You know, if you read it, it says pain in the right second MPJ. So I, if I was noting medial drift, and again, I'm judicious with my use of intra-articular steroids, the same as I am. If I'm seeing that and they're having pain and it's not working increased drift, then I've usually not, my experience is that they don't always respond very well to a steroid in intra-articular. But the injection was in the third interspace. On intra-articular on that.
And I didn't see ever in your, in your notes any description of the, you know, the plantar fat pad. I, you know, that was something I didn't see anywhere in your notes. So. Additional questions for Dr. Cole?
I know.
Madam Chair, board members.
Yes, ma'am.
I apologize for the interruption, but I did get a request from the complainant, TT. If you're willing to hear her, she would like to speak again.
We can, well, okay. So I'll ask you gentlemen to have a seat back.
I would just like to clarify just a couple of things that Dr. Bangart said. He said, you know, he did 11 injections, but not all into my right foot. They were all into my right foot. I have the complaint that I submitted has all of his notes and my insurance explanation of benefits. And there were more than 11 injections because he did injections in my left foot also, but there were 11 in my right foot. And never did he nor any of his assistants do listen to my heart or take my blood pressure. The only question that they asked me is what medications I was on. Thank you.
I am going to make a motion to enter into executive session at 10:32 for the purpose of receiving legal advice.
Okay.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? We'll be back. So we will be back on record at 10:51 a.m. And back considering case number 19-32-C with Dr. Bangart. And I think at this time we need to, you know, clarify our concerns and our facts that we've heard so that we can discuss what action we would like to see taken.
My concerns is the, even though it was a low dose of steroid injections, it was more, my problem is the standard of care. There's no official article that says 3 injections, 4 injections, 5 injections is the amount that we shouldn't go above. And there is, I do have a concern with how many injections and what was happening through the progress of the patient.
Yes, cortisone has effects on the body. Unfortunately, it can take and help reduce the pain. It can also thin the surrounding structures. Although I expect the concerns of that performance, the number of injections in the literature that also supports.
And in conjunction with my colleagues here, you know, the recognition of, you know, a biomechanical structure and how that, you know, affects your treatment, like I said, you know, using it judiciously, but going back to some of the what's the underlying cause of why these things are happening. And I think that's so much a part of treatment here in these kind of situations. We also, in the past, I believe, there's been a letter of concern issued before in the same regard of injections back in 2017. So that is my thought, that I never again saw anything in a differential diagnosis in the chart indicating the pot, you know, if there was concern over a possibility of a plantar plate tear, but was never actually indicated in the differential diagnosis. So that's where I'm, my concern is too, again, is that was this, how strongly was that considered in this case, along again, like I said, with how the biomechanics of that foot works as being the basis for everything. For, you know, when you decide surgery on somebody, you've studied the biomechanics of that foot, and you know what the effect of your surgery is going to do to the biomechanics. Anyway, so that is how I feel. Mr. Rhodes, did you have any comments you'd like to make? So that, you know, the question is, does this, you know, what level does this rise to?
not an issue of negligence, you know, malpractice or, you know, whatever, you know, that level is, I don't believe is obviously is even on the table here or anything. But my feeling is I think we should offer a non-disciplinary consent agreement, which would involve continuing education regarding the latest in the recognition of plantar plate injuries, treatment of such, surgical-related biomechanics, I believe, might be a topic to address, just as we all need, reminders and reviews. And then, you know, if the other members feel that if the chart review is apparent at this time, or if we approach this from an educational standpoint, that would be our approach. So I'd like your opinion.
For me, there was a higher level letter from the chart review after the fourth injection of empathy. What is that? I'm thinking
so, Dr. Iwana, what would your thought be on period of time? How many charts?
Sure, within, I'd say about this three chart within a 6 month period of time. You get more than four injections within 6 months.
So, for greater than
four?
Okay.
Would there be a certain amount of steroid injections that would prompt the review?
After three, the fourth one. Pardon? After three, the fourth one.
Okay.
And within within 6 months?
Yes.
Okay. And the CME, how many hours would you think would be appropriate? Like I said, my thought is, you know, about surgical biomechanics and plantar plate injury.
Six
total, three in each?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's always in addition to the 25 CME for a licensure, and it obviously has to be approved by the board.
Madam Chair, board members, I would like one point of clarification. With the chart review, it had been three charts that you want to see. So within the last 6 months, correct?
No, the order will go for 6 months.
Okay.
But Dr. Iwano's recommendation was when the patient is passed, when they've already received three injections, so... and going on to maybe a fourth, so that may be how we'll be able to pick those, you know, that'll just have to come from, you know, having connection to the office to say, okay, you have to, if you would have to get a patient list of where that occurred.
And that's where I was heading.
And then the investigator could select from those.
Okay.
To get, you know.
Same foot, though.
Yeah. Same area, yeah, just on one foot, not a bilateral case.
Okay, thank you.
Should this non-disciplinary be declined, what would we go to an informal hearing?
Yes,
yes, we would. And it would be appropriate to ask now if the respondent would be amiable to signing that consent agreement.
Well, I think that's something we should discuss. So would you mind if we stepped outside and Dr. Bangert had the benefit of counsel?
Is that appropriate? Because in the past, I would thought the attorneys worked with each other, and then we had like 30 days to accept or not during that time frame.
Yes, absolutely. That would be correct. And it would have the language for rehearing or review in that consent if you wish to not sign it and ask for a rehearing.
That's perfect.
Do you need me to repeat that motion, or do we have everything?
Can I ask a clarifying question? How much CE, just for my notes, how much CE in addition to the 25-year lease?
Six.
Thanks.
So, Heather, do you have all those components? Okay, so we don't need everybody's clear. Okay, so I made the motion. Did I have a second?
Second.
And we've discussed. Do you want to discuss any more? Anything else? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. So that will be drafted and reviewed and then presented to Mr. Saunders and Dr. Banger. Thank you. Okay, we move on to issuance of licenses under heading 6B, and our first is Dr. Is that Ayuranka Begur? I'm not sure how the doctor pronounces her name. I believe the doctor has a letter from her residency director that she will be completed on 6/30/20. Everything else in her file and application was complete, to my knowledge, right, Heather? Mm-hmm. So I would make a motion to issue a license upon receipt of knowledge of a successful completion of her residency and payment of said fee.
Second.
Discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. And I will, since we have Dr. Hayden Poulsen, he also has a letter from the residency into the city indicating, that he completed that residency in 6/30/19, so he's already completed that. He's been working in Salt Lake City. His Utah license is in good standing, so he is, everything is complete for him. He's met all requirements, so I will offer a motion to accept to issue a license to Dr. Hayden Poulsen on receipt of said fee.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. And Dr. Cara Brock is back, and I believe she did have Dr. Dancho indicate by letter that the doctor has fulfilled her residency requirements, that her graduation date is 6/30/20. And I believe Dr. Dancho sent a lot more information this time, which I think was a little bit more showing, what the actual requirements are. So in response to the other people who from the same program, that's what our state statute says, satisfactory completion of a residency, and that's what's on our book currently. So everything's here and complete. So I will make a motion to issue Dr. Brock her license number, have she paid? Not yet. Okay.
Not
so it could be issued, on the payment of the fee.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No practicing. And next is compliance update. Dr. Heyman, did you receive anything from him about if he performed any osteotomies?
I have not received any correspondence from Dr. Heyman I will contact him if I don't hear from him within a few weeks. It's never a set day that he emails me, so I never really know when I'm going to get the email from him. But if I don't hear from him, I'll contact him.
Okay, so, Kim, if we don't get any response, how much time do we, I mean, if it becomes an issue of a non-compliance to a board order?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So how many days do we usually have?
I don't think that there's a specified amount of time. I just, for my own calendar purposes, was going to follow up with him within a week or two if I don't hear from him. And then at that point, if I still have no response, then I would call him.
Jesus. Because I'm trying to, have we had issues in the past with his response being timely? It's usually like the day before, but he's never missed a, haven't had a prod to get.
Yeah, I haven't had no problems responding with him in the past.
Next is Dr. Farrell.
And I did receive correspondence from Dr. Farrell that he has not performed any nerve decompression surgeries in January of 2020. Dr. Polakoff does have the patient file for the nerve decompression that he completed in December of 2019, and she's working on that. So when I have that report, that will come before the board. And in regards to his two cases, they've been continued, and the board will hear him at a future meeting.
And then your executive director's report.
So update on the roles. I did hear from the board's OSPB analyst, Stephanie Sparra, and she had some questions regarding the temporary application fee that the board wants to implement, the $100 fee. So I answered those questions. I did get her the information regarding out-of-state applications that the board receives, and it's over half. Half of the board's applications are from individuals who are applying that are out-of-state. And I asked her to give me a time frame because the first exemption request was put in last April. The second one was put in September of 2019. So she said she should be able to meet with her supervisor within the next couple of weeks and then hopefully get back to me. So hopefully it's not too much longer. Dr. Campbell and I, moving on to the next item, we did go to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee last Wednesday, in which they heard the Podiatry Board Bill, SB 1087, and there was a last-minute amendment, as the board is aware, and the bill passed unanimously. They had no questions. So it went really well, I think. And then a question keeps coming up regarding podiatric medical assistance, and I've addressed it with the association and with Department of Health Services. If it's something that the board wanted to consider regulating that profession, it would be a very long process. And I kind of put a little bit of information in my executive director's report, but basically it would require a sunrise process. So you'd have to make rules, statutes, create fees, and so forth. So that's something that I can put on a future agenda if the board wishes on, or it's, you know, if the board wants to think about it and possibly in the future, just keep me updated. And then with the I have an updated budget, and then you have the most updated complaint log.
And can I go back to the issue with the legislative
The podiatric medical assistance, or the
no, the one about the, you know, the history and principal issue that Dr. Foreman had forwarded that information to you from Dr.
Peters
from the some fellow named Chad at the APMA that made remarks about me wanting to take podiatry out of parity with the other, you know, medical professions, and that's not what, you know, we're here to protect the public. And so, you know, years ago, and I know, you know, our sessions are recorded. People can listen. Sometimes it probably isn't as distinct as it should be, and assumptions, I believe, were made. And about this issue of history. So I just, you know, kind of, I'm sure we're going to continue to get questions from this issue.
And I did follow up with Mary Peters, and I did receive a response from her, and she seemed to understand and let the national people know that there's not an issue, and that they are supportive of our bill, SB 1087. And she did ask me to let her know if I needed anything from the association.
I don't know if it's somebody just trying to make trouble, and because that's obviously is not, you know, not what we're trying to do. And again, today, that's why, you know, when I picked up this, I can talk about this, can I? Because of the case we just heard and the performance of a full HMP where the patient says, no, you didn't do anything. And here it's listed, but not billed. It wasn't, you know, the level of service wasn't billed for because, you know, so again, you know, yeah, they say, well, we were trained in our residency. Yeah, but are you listening to hearts ever? You know, I go back to the same thing. So I'm just you know, people making remarks and comments that don't know the situation and what's going on. So I just wanted us to all be prepared.
The board can make a recommendation to the AZPMA to have an HMP class offered, a seminar offered that can give a certificate that they've been trained in, or
yeah, but I don't know how, you know, Seamus, how that goes with, you know, you've got, that's an addition to the practice act, and do you have to go through a sunrise process or any of that? I mean, you know,
for
if, you know, these
industries and
physicals. Yeah, you know, this issue, you know, because like this, or APMA, you know, saying that, well, this just knocks down parity for podiatric physicians and other physicians. You know, I was trained to do them in my residency, and I did them as a student. But to receive parity with that, you know, I mean, you've got to have the same level of training that an MD has, in my opinion. And so I want to know what malpractice insurance people are saying about podiatrists doing that. And again, you know, that too about how what hospital staff guidelines are, and Dr. Bangard indicated that they, you know, where he works, they take his HMP. So I mean, it's going to be different in all locations in the state. It's not going to be same for every hospital staff and things.
And Madam Chair and Seamus, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the intent of the statute is not to try to regulate each licensee in that, making sure that they're qualified to do it. I think the intent of the language is to let a podiatrist know that if they're qualified to do it, they can, as long as it's relevant to the condition that's being treated. And so if a complaint were brought before the board, then it would be up to the board to determine whether or not that history and physical that they performed was appropriate.
Correct.
And the bottom line, a licensure is from the leg to the foot. So my problem is that's fine to do the history and physical, but if something does arise for the board,
other than the leg or the foot.
Because with the amendment, the way the amendment was written, it says within the profession scope of practice. So that gives the board the authority to determine whether or not it was in the professional's scope of practice. And then if a complaint were to come before the board, then you could start asking for credentials, education, background, you know, that sort of information.
Yeah, that's a very good question.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the board, I think that would be a question for you to decide, looking at all the information and the facts, and then to determine whether, you know, that licensee and what they did comes under your jurisdiction.
All right. I just wanted to, you know, be clear on that, that everybody, you know, that know, licensees know the purpose of this. You know, we're just trying to improve, you know, because we got so many questions about that. We just want, you know, good clarification for these questions that we get. And again, like I said, we're here to protect the public and everything else.
I think the sunrise process you were talking about was for the podium.
That's for the podium, yeah. But that's why I was just questioning if, you know, if that would, we didn't require that for those, what we were trying to verbiage. So,
but again, we have to have the AZPMA, they're the ones who are up, they're going to lead this through any kind of legislation to allow the board to be able to regulate podiatric medical assistance licensure.
And, you know, I don't, years ago, like, and I mentioned to Heather and I, you know, remember when you were like the AZPMA vice president, and you came to board meetings, and it was a great way to disseminate information to the association. And I think, you know, that would be a helpful thing, because, like I said, listening to the tapes, you don't get everything, and you can't be there and be to a call to the public to ask questions. Which it's too bad that's not done anymore.
And if I could just add one more point in the podiatric medical assistance, right now with this administration, the atmosphere is less regulation. So that might be something that the board wants to keep in mind, too.
Well, if there's less regulation, why isn't the back to the less regulated podiatric medical x-ray.
I understand.
Because it worked for 20-something years, so.
Yeah, and that was a result of the MRTB being disbanded.
And do we have any summary of current events?
The next item is the item 8, the legislative update.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we didn't. Pardon.
So I can go through each of these quickly. None of them have moved any further since this memo. SB 1211, this would mandate that all rules will expire on July 1st of 2022, and that each agency would have to request from the legislature that their rules be extended. And again, it hasn't moved. It's still just had a second read. It's still early in the session. SB 1212, this is in regards to the universal recognition application, and basically, it's just going to clean up that bill a little bit that passed, and it's going to provide some guidance regarding the definition of residency. SB 1274. And since I submitted this memo to the board, I believe that a few other agencies have been added into this. And right now, it only affects Board of Technical Registration, Board of Barbers, Board of Cosmetology at the time that I wrote the memo. But I believe like Board of Accountancy is now included. Basically, this is going to change the composition of board members. So the intent is to increase the amount of public members and decrease the amount of professional members.
Is that going to affect boards of what sizes?
Right now, it's cosmetology, barbers, technical registration. I believe the Board of Accountancy has been added in. I don't recall what other agencies, but I know cosmetology is a huge board, and so is barbers. Technical registration has a lot of licensees as well. I think it's affecting funeral board. Board. If my memory is serving me correctly, I believe it's affecting funeral board. House Bill 2408. This will affect our licensees if it passes. This will allow a licensee who provides volunteer services to an approved patient or eligible patient, and an eligible patient is defined as somebody who does not have health insurance and who doesn't exceed the federal poverty level, and then a person eligible under ACCESS, they could receive 1 hour of continuing education for each hour of free medical services up to a maximum of 8 hours. House Bill 2288. This would require that a regulatory agency waive the initial license fee for any veteran and any active duty military service member or their spouse. House Bill 2184, it would just require agencies to put a paragraph either on their website or on a licensing application regarding it's universal recognition. House Bill 2713. This just adds to what an appealable agency action is. This would put an administratively complete application under that section. As of right now, if an application is not administratively complete within 365 days, it's closed. Administratively closed, and there's no appeal rights. This would allow an appeal right. And House Bill 2740 is a consolidation bill. It proposes the consolidation of the Massage Therapy Board, Barber Board, and Cosmetology Board. And that's my summary, unless you guys have any questions. And I don't know if I'm missing any, Seamus, if you know of any bills that I didn't cover.
I do not. It looks like you've covered them all.
Summary of current events. I'm sorry. I was.
And I do not have any.
And we have no public to call to currently. So does anyone have any items they'd like to have put on future? Our next meeting is Wednesday, March the 11th at 2020. And we're still in this room, correct? Yes. Oh. And I will move to adjourn at 11:24 a.m. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you.